Have you seen Chuck Norris lately? He's still kicking butt and staying active well into his 80s. What's even more shocking is he looks more jacked than ever and seems to have more energy than guys half his age. And it's all thanks to Morning Kick, a revolutionary new daily drink from Roundhouse Provisions that combines ultra-potent greens like spirulina and kale with probiotics, prebiotics, collagen, and even ashwagandha. Just mix with water, stir, and enjoy. Unlike other green drinks out there, this one tastes exactly like strawberry lemonade and has hundreds of five-star reviews. Go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 for up to 44% off your regular priced order. Plus, every purchase is backed by a 90-day money-back guarantee. So if you want to experience smoother digestion, a boost of energy, and just an overall healthier body, then go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 today. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Results can vary.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to Board Games Anonymous, the podcast of board gamers and the insane fun we have at the table together. This is Chris.
And Stephanie.
This is episode 487, Going Analog, translating video games to cardboard. We like to thank all our Patreon backers for helping us bring you a brand new episode. Hey friends, we're back, and we're at Gen Con Live 2024! Woo! We're here! Wow! Look at all the games! There's games! Dude!
I'm sorry.
We're here?
No.
We're not? No, we're here!
No.
No.
I know, they told me not to break the illusion, but I'm sorry. I can't watch.
No.
It's too hard.
No, I want to go to Gen Con. That's where the games are.
I know. Well, the games are also in our homes, so.
What?
There's a lot of them.
No, I don't know about that.
I got a spreadsheet. You want some? I'm trying to clear some space.
There you go. That'll make me happy. I have to pick something up. It's the time of year that you pick up games, so just wave the spreadsheet under my nose, and I'll feel the vibe. I'll smell the cardboard.
Yeah, it's funny. I've actually been selling some games. Like, I actually have a spreadsheet, and several people came and picked stuff up locally, and two separate people are like, "Oh, are you clearing space for Gen Con?" And it's like, no, not this year. I should have in the past, and now I have to do this just because. And they're like, oh, you're not going? I'm like, totally apropos of nothing. I don't know these people. It's a 3-hour flight. It's not like sure. I'm like, can drive over there. So just like, yeah, you're not going to Gen Con. You have all these games. I'm like,
man, I don't even know you anymore.
Thanks, that's... stranger, for making me feel bad.
Yeah, the 100+ emails. And all the social media posts and things like that. Like, we're going to meet up, right? I'm going to see you here, right? Do you want to schedule something? Just like, you guys are killing me.
We can't do it. We can't. And this is how much we love Board Game Academics, because that was our convention for the summer. That's what we could afford to do.
It's true. It was quite a penny to pinch. So, but yeah, no, I'm feeling it. Gen Cant is just not doing it for me this year.
No. Well, I mean, hey, we got our PAX stuff came in today. We were applying for passes and stuff. It's not that far away. It's 4 months.
Got to hold out.
Somehow,
try to find a way to hold out. Keep my head down. Don't look at social media.
You can do it,
man.
I believe in you.
Don't look directly at social media. Don't look at it. People are having fun. So hopefully you are listening to this podcast coming back from Gen Con or just recovering from Gen Con by the time this pops out. And hopefully you had the best time in the world. We'll actually be talking about Gen Con next week. We'll give you a full recap of everything that went down there. While Anthony and I were not there, a bunch of people on our team were. So we'll actually have some, you know, direct on the ground feedback for some games, some convention materials, some history of stuff that went down, general recap of numbers and fun stuff like that, and especially from trade day. Because obviously we want to get more games out there as much as possible. And we have some really big reporting from there. So a lot of good stuff happened, and hopefully everyone had the best time in the world. Just don't tell us about it directly. Can't take it right now.
Chris can't handle it. Just can't handle it.
I need to pick up some games. I'm going to go by Anthony's house and just like walk around, stand in line, and then take a couple of games and walk around the block a couple of times until my hands start burning from the weight, you know. And
yeah. Like, to tell my kids to go stand downstairs. I'm like, okay, Chris is going to come stand behind you because he needs to feel like he's waiting for something.
That's okay. Right. He needs to stand outside the house for about, you know, 2 hours in line with the mom. Don't let him in. I know it's raining outside. Just don't let him in yet.
Yeah. He's going to build a card tower in the living room. It's fine. Because before he leaves, he'll knock it down with pennies.
That's right. From the stairway. You'll just throw it. just be careful you don't get directly in his way. It's fine. Yeah.
My wife's like, should we call somebody?
Yeah. Aw, Gen Con. We miss you very much out there. All right. Well, we'll talk about that more next week when we have all the fun stuff happening. But before we get into that, Anthony, we want to talk about what all our friends are talking about. What's our question of the week?
All right. So we are talking video games this week, and specifically how the theme of a video game or the content thereof can be translated into cardboard effectively, right? So you go back a few years and it wasn't always effective, but in the last like 5-10 years, we've had a bunch of these things that really translate quite well. And so we're going to talk about how they do that and why, what works, what elements make them work. So in that vein, I asked our listeners to tell us what's a video game mechanic that you think makes the best transition to tabletop. Or would make if it doesn't exist yet. So it basically, what's in a video game that works particularly well when you put it in cardboard? Because not everything does. It can't, right? Like the computer programming and the AI and everything built into a video game is unique in a special ways. Mm-hmm. So Drew over on the Patreon says, Fog of War. I applaud efforts for games to try and implement Fog of War, Undaunted's deck bloating, Columbia's block war game series, and the hidden movement mechanic in general. Still, more can be done to explore this gaming mechanic, a challenging mechanic to implement with shared board and pieces. Fog of War is interesting. It's really, honestly, fairly simple in like a 4X game on the computer. Like, you're playing, you know, Solaris, or you're playing Civ 4, Civ 5, whatever. It's just there. But in a board game format, how do you replicate that in a way that's makes sense for both sides? So that's an interesting one. Mm-hmm. Over on the Facebook page, we had Dave, a friend of the show, said side-scrolling. So you've got monsters spawning. You have to escape the map to get to the next one. Cooperative. So, you know, like the old beat-em-ups, which I think there's a few games that have done this to some degree, but they often tend to be big and sprawling, like a lot of stuff in the box. Like, how do you boil that down mechanically? He mentions Thunder Road kind of sort of doing this, which I could see. Not a lot. Blake mentions the Darkest Dungeon board game, but I like the bad things that can happen to your characters in the video game. So just kind of replicating that sense of like going into the space and constantly having bad things happen. Chris mentions wanting to see a Metroidvania turn into a board game.
Ooh, that's cool.
So yeah, Metroidvania is one of my favorite genres, just going into a space and exploring, and you can't access a lot of stuff until you get further on, you get new equipment, and you go back. It's a lot of like back and forth on the map. So like, how would you replicate that in a board game space where it's not just like walking around rolling dice? Because that would be boring. He also mentions stealth. So there's been a bunch of games that try to do stealth, and then specifically mentions the Metal Gear Solid game that's coming out soon, Emerson Matsuchi.
Yeah.
Which will almost certainly be all stealth, because that's what that video game is. It better be all stealth. So, and then Bullet Hell Games is another one he mentions. Level 99 Games has Bullet Heart. But that's a fairly short, direct, simple. I mean, it does that, but like, how do you build on that? So, So a lot of good answers there. We're going to talk today about more of those things. So I'm not going to share necessarily more of my answers because I think it's in the list later. But there are certain things that do work.
Gotcha. Yeah, I think so. And I think more and more as video games have become more accepted as mainstream art and mainstream pastime. I mean, they were always kind of somewhat niche, but now it is this thing. And now that that's become that, the mechanics and the different aspects of that kind of medium have translated in a lot of places. And I think also when we think about just things in general or life in general, a lot of times we are thinking or we are talking about ourselves in reference to those memes. Mm-hmm. So it's nice to see that stuff translate over so well in mm-hmm. most cases, but I guess that's going to be our feature review, so we don't want to give all of that away.
Right.
But yeah, no, I mean, revolutionize so many different concepts of gameplay, and all of them are dynamic, and all of them are different perspectives, and again, just brilliant ideas across the board.
Yep.
All right, so if you'd like to join us on all our fun social media nonsense, we are pretty much everywhere, except where places are not happening too much. But ideally Facebook. I don't know why, but that seems to be a place where things kind of settled. So Facebook is probably the best place to find us for our question of the week. Or, of course, our Patreon account, patreon.com/BGA. Thank you all for joining our Patreon account. And, of course, our Discord channel. Our Discord channel has all the fun stuff that's happening with Board Gamers Anonymous and Board Game Academics. And again, you could always email us, anthony@boardgamersanonymous.com or chris@boardgamersanonymous.com. Love to hear from you. And if you see us at Gen Con, it's not us. So one place where you cannot find us, but you will definitely find us at PAX Unplugged 2024. So feel free to come up and say hi and share what your answer to this question might be this week. All right, so that's what everyone's saying out there. Anthony, let's talk about the games we want to get to the table. Let's talk about our acquisition disorders.
All right. So this is a weird one because it's not new at all. Actually, it's a fairly old game from way back in 2020. Comic Hunters.
Yeah.
So this was a game that was released, I want to say, in Brazil.
Yes.
In
South America. Yeah.
Never got a release up here, but it had...
Because of IP stuff, right?
Yeah, it's like a weird... Like the way the licenses worked. Yeah. So it's a game about collecting Marvel comics, which... It's such a cool theme by itself, but it is licensed. So it's not just a game about collecting comics. It's literally like, here is Black Panther number one. Here is the first appearance of the Wolverine and the Hulk, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you are collecting these things and building out your collection and moving up these different tracks based on the characters that you're focused on for like first appearances, number one, new visuals, special editions, memorable things that happened, you know, stuff that people collect. Very cool game. Been incredibly hard to find if you're not in one of the regions where it was released. It's relatively simple by all accounts. It's an hour long. It's like an action-based or an auction-based system, and you're trying to set collection within that. But just the idea that they got all this artwork, right, from the Marvel comics, like if you look at the pictures on Board Game Geek, it's like all these covers, right, from all the classic Marvel comics. But it never came here. And so sometime last winter, Arcane Wonders picked up the license working with Spin Master, who's worked with Marvel before.
Sure.
And they were able to make all this work.
Fantastic.
And I guess it kind of came out of Tom Vassell being like, this is great. Like, at least that's what they claim. That's what Arcane Wonders says. Like, Tom Vassell brought it to them and said, you really have to get this game into North America. And then they worked to figure out the way to get the licensing to work. Because at a certain point, they're like, we'll make it generic. I'm like, well, no.
I heard that. Yeah.
Yeah, like, then it's just another set collection game. Like, we need the Marvel license.
Yeah.
So, they did it. It's coming. It's going to be at Barnes & Noble and on Amazon. They say it's a Barnes & Noble exclusive, but there is an Amazon listing, so we'll see. And it came out a few days ago.
Oh, okay.
And by all accounts, I couldn't find copies near me, but it is in stock online.
Oh,
so
okay.
You can get it shipped. It's like $22.
That's not bad.
So it's Spin Master pricing, which is amazing. So it means they mass produced it. So hopefully it'll be in print for a while. So this is a game I had on my radar for a long time. Not to the point I would go hunt it down on eBay, but it was one of those things like, oh, if they ever bring it here, I'll get it. And then they did. And I didn't realize that it had come out already. And so I'm like, I will have to pick this up because I love the theme. I love the, like, it's Marvel stuff, but it's like the meta part of it, right? It's the collecting of the comics. Sure. So fantastic. It's very cool.
And just basically straight up set collecting.
Yeah. Yeah. Basically. It's a very light game. It's the theme is really what drives it, seemingly. And, you know, like, mechanically, it seems perfectly fine. Like, it's not like it's a bad game. People seem to like it fine otherwise. But, you know, it's really just getting that artwork on the cards. That's
sure. Cool. Yeah. And that works best for a general audience when it's just, it's one thing.
Yeah.
It's not challenging anything else as far as that's concerned. And like I said, the IP makes it the game, because why else would you bother set collecting? Because there's so many set collecting games out there and they're good.
Right.
But, you know, typically if it's just set collecting, it has to be a theme, because the prime mechanic is I am spending all my mental energy on these pictures. So,
right. Yeah.
It lends itself to that. Not like you said, it's a good idea, right? It certainly works very well because Spin Master's right up their alley.
Yeah, no, and it all came together nicely and it worked. And you know what? If it sells well, hopefully we get more, right?
Sure.
If we get, you know, newer comics within that thread. A lot of this is more classic. Maybe we get specific ones just for one character and they go really deep on it.
Oh,
like,
sure.
You're like, here's Fantastic Four and all their various, you know, runs they've done. One of those. Yeah.
Here's DC. Yeah,
that'd be cool. I mean, it's a lot of work and it's a lot of licensing issues and like who owns the rights to these various things. But I don't know. I think it's fantastic. I would like to get it. So I'll probably pick this up at some point.
Well, if you're at Gen Con, I'm just saying.
Yeah, well, you know what? Yeah, nice spreadsheet. I got to deal with that.
Yeah, no, it's good. Because again, I think I did hear people being very excited about this and spending crazy amounts of money in the secondary market for it.
Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, you can pick it up for, I'm looking right now, Barnes & Noble, $22.49.
Yeah, very cheap. Yeah. Comic Hunters, everybody, check it out.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. This is something that doesn't have a lot of information, but I've been sitting on it for quite some time, and I thought you were going to talk about it before I got to it.
Yeah.
But we have to talk about it because it's a thing. It's Speakeasy. This is a game from the designer we all know and love, Vitaly Cerda. And even more importantly, in some cases, depending on how you look at it, the artist Ian O'Toole. And throw together their classic Three Musketeer trio of Eagle Griffin Games. And you yet again have one of the big, beautiful productions of a Vitaly Cerda game. So, in Speakeasy, you're going to be earning money by running a Manhattan Speakeasy during Prohibition, as you figure, 1920s. And you're dealing with mobsters. You're in the mob in this case. And it's all about claiming territory, dealing with Manhattan, and trying to traffic the liquor during that time, dealing with the cops and such. And basically, the game comes down to be a worker placement card management game. Take on one of the roles of the mobsters. You're managing the logistics of your speakeasy empire in Manhattan. So it's more Vitaly Cerda. It's not up yet for purchase or backing at this point, but it has all of the elements. There's some pictures out there right now you could take a look at. And again, it's beautiful artwork from Ian O'Toole. I think this is one of his best covers that he's ever produced, and graphic design looks nice and sharp. You know, you're dealing with Manhattan back in the day, and we're looking at a really fine production as far as all the meeples and the, you know, the liquor and the cars and the trucks and stuff like that. So we've seen this theme before. It's not necessarily anything new, but certainly it's a new take for Vitaly Cerda. So Speakeasy, coming to you soon.
Yeah, I love the look of it, and I love that Lacerda's getting back to like more thematic games, because his last couple have been somewhat abstract.
Sure.
And I don't have a problem with an abstract Euro, it's just his games are so complex, when they get abstract, they're really hard to wrap your brain around.
Yeah.
And even harder to teach, which is really the barrier for these. Like, I'm like, I get it, but teaching this is a pain in the butt.
Sure.
And his games, the reason I always liked them is that they were easy to teach. No matter how complex they were, I'm like, well, this makes sense because it goes into this and this and this, right? So I love that he's coming back to that. Like, this is the theme that makes sense. The mechanics seem to, like, flow really well.
Sure.
I've never really been a huge fan of, like, the 1920s mobster era type stuff. So we'll see what the game looks like and how much they charge for it. But, yeah, I definitely have it saved on my end, too.
Sure. It'll be out on Kickstarter. They're talking about demos at Essen. And Kickstarter probably around September 26th.
Okay.
So you have a chance. The Talisker games, especially with Ian O'Toole and Eagle Griffin Games, has almost always been an instant buy for me. Mm-hmm. Obviously, the last couple of games have been a little iffy. So I'm going to wait and see instead of, like, automatically buy this when it comes out. And as you said, not necessarily the theme that I'm necessarily thrilled about, but I do like the fact, like you said, his games are complicated, but his games are typically thematic enough that they do teach themselves just by in interplay with the different dynamics.
Right. Yeah. It's interesting. So, like, I've reached the point with Lacerda games, you know, for a long time, it was the same with Feld. Like, I'm going to collect all of them. I have every one, even the ones I don't like.
Gotta catch them all.
And then eventually, you know, they started selling for $500 a piece, and I was like, eh, I'm out.
Yeah.
Lacerda kind of hit the same point where I'm like, I can't really wrap my brain around Weather Machine. I don't think I want to teach it. And so I sold it. And then once I sold that, I'm like, well, I don't really love Escape Plan. So I sold that. And so now I'm like, well, I don't need to have all of them then because I got rid of a couple of them.
It broke the bridge. So, yeah.
Right. So now I'm just being a lot more particular. And so, like, I really will dig in on this and make sure it's a good fit before I back it. But it's Lacerda, so it starts with, like,
and it's Ian O'Toole, and it's Eagle Griffin Games, so it'll be a solid production at the very least.
Yeah, we'll just see what it costs, because these things, like, his games used to be like, it's $100, and now it's like, 170, you know?
Yeah. They've always been very expensive. They've always been, like, he led, but I will say the one thing about it was the production was always high quality, and Ian O'Toole's artwork was exceptional. Yeah, yeah. So it never felt bad to back his stuff.
No.
Because you got something that was, you know, had a lot to it. And the artwork was excellent. And the graphic design was excellent. And Eagle Griffin did a great production. And it was a big box.
Right.
But it wasn't, like, an excessively big box.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's one of those things. Like, I still, like, these are games I would pull out to show people. Like, this is amazing. Look how great this looks. So.
Yeah, we've certainly turned a corner a little bit on that. So, Inventions, and as you said, Weather Machine. So, we'll see.
At Kroger Pharmacy, Care is making it easy to get vaccinated. Care is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. Care is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.
Cool.
All right. Well, that's everything that we wanted to the table. Let's talk about the games that did hit the table this week, and we'll let you know if those games are a buy and you should run out and pick those games up. If those games are a play and you should sit down and enjoy them. If those games are a dodge, and of course you should avoid them, or in fact, those games are the dreaded burn, and by all means, burn the heck out of them. Anthony, what'd you play this week?
All right, so I played a game that I actually played this game a long time ago, and like a prototype of it, like back the first time it was on Kickstarter, I think. And then I didn't play it a long time. I don't even know if I ever formally reviewed it, but then I did back the second edition with the expansion, and that's Campaign Trail. This is a game about the American election system. So it's a weird thing to be playing it now. And they ran this at the time they ran it, and I don't even know why I backed it, because I wanted nothing to do with politics at the time, but they ran it during the election season in 2020.
Yeah.
So this funded on November 1st, 2020. Maybe I went in after the fact. I don't remember. But I do have it. It was on my shelf and looking for games to get out and try that are new to me. And this one's like, well, this is thematic. We're in the middle of an election and, you know, for good or bad.
It's a better election to play and follow.
Right. So it's the game itself, there's a lot here. There's a lot of pieces. It's big. It's sprawling. It takes up a lot of space on the table. But it's actually fairly simple. So, like, mechanically. It's, like, there are rules videos on YouTube that are 10 minutes long, and it's really all you need. Like, you don't really need much more than that. So it is a fairly simple game. But the complexity comes out in how you manipulate the space and move the votes around. So how the game works is you have a map of the United States. All the states are broken up. Each state has issues that they care about. Each state also has, like, ethical alignments. Mm-hmm. And each state also has, like, party alignments. So there's, like, primary tiebreakers. And this is, determines, like, what starts on the map. The interesting thing about this is that for balance purposes, or other reasons, I'm not really sure why, there are three parties in the box. We don't have a three-party system, but the game has three parties. So immediately there's a little bit of a suspension of disbelief. Like, the game's not really fully representing the American electoral system. Not like, and there are games that do. Like, 1960 Making the President is a great two-player electoral game where you play through the Electoral College. This is not that. So you kind of have to get that out of your head right away, or you're going to be annoyed. like I started to be, and then I was like, okay, it's just a game. It's fine. So there are the Democratic Party, the Republican Party, and then Libertarian is the third party that they threw in there. There's an expansion for the Green Party as well, the fourth one.
Sure.
And then that's what the Kickstarter was. So I did not play with the Green Party, but it does throw in some other different mechanics, and you get little green turtles, which is pretty cool.
That's awesome.
Yeah, the green turtles are cool.
Teenage Mutant Green Party turtles.
Yeah, Libertarians are porcupines, and the Green Party is turtles, which I'm like, give me porcupines and turtles, because that's better than donkeys and elephants.
It is.
Yeah.
Jeez. Progressives isn't a half shell. Turtle
power. Good. So the game itself is, it's card driven, right? So you have a hand of cards, and those cards can do one of six different things. So you have all these different actions you can take. You can raise funds, so they each have like a number on them. Here's how much money you can raise with them. You can collect voters, like register them, which is like a weird mechanic because you have undecided voters are off to the side, and then you can register those voters and they come to your pool, and then you can take it from your pool and place them onto the map with different actions. Which is not really how it works. Registering the voters doesn't mean they're definitely going to vote for you, but you know, there's correlation. Then you have options to move around the map, so you can travel. You have like one little meeple that you move around with. If you're playing with two players or three players, everybody's just a presidential candidate. You have the one meeple. You can play with up to six players, though, or eight players if you're playing with the Green Party. And then you play in teams where you're a president and a vice presidential candidate. So you have two different people who can move around the map. I haven't done that. I don't know that I ever will, because I don't know that I would be able to get a group of 68 people together who are ideologically aligned enough not to get in a fight over this game. But it seems like 2 to 3 is the way people prefer to play it, based on what's on BoardGameGeek, though. As you move around, there's like these different sections, and then you're just trying to get votes out on the map. So you can do that with campaign actions, where you pay money to place voters into different regions, up to six. You can do this with issues-based things. You can advertise based on the issues on a card, and this lets you pay a certain amount per issue icon and then place voters in each of the states that represents those issues. And then there's cards and text on the cards. It takes various different actions. And there's like 100 something cards in the deck. So there's a lot of different things you can do. Like, some of these are permanent actions that give you bonuses when you do certain things. Other things are immediate actions. Each of the candidates also has like something that they're good at and something that they're bad at. So you have like an advantage and a disadvantage for each candidate, which I always like when you have the asymmetry. It's not just like, you're good at this, this is what breaks the game for you. It's also, you know, you get this, but then this other thing is bad for you. So it kind of focuses your attention a little bit. And so you go around and you do that in three rounds, just around and around and around until you run out of cards. And then you have debates between those three rounds and then the end of the game. The debates are not as interesting. So you have six issues in the debate, and you just take turns playing cards that have those issue icons, and you move the icons around. So it's like a tug of war, and it's really just based on what cards you've managed to keep in your hand for this part of the game. I found it not to be particularly interesting. It can let you put a lot of voters out if you play it right, but at the same time, you're not using any card text. There's not really a lot of it's semi-deterministic because it's based on the cards you have, but you don't know what your opponents are going to have or how they're going to use them. So it's an interesting game in a lot of ways, right? But the thing about it, like, as a representation of the voting system, again, we have three or four parties here, any of which can win. Not really representative of that system, which is whatever, that's fine, but it's not really how our system works. Also, the states themselves, it's a free-for-all, right? You don't really, other than like how it starts at the beginning of the map, any party can win any state, which you'd have to do for the balance of the game for it to be a good Euro game, but it doesn't, again, doesn't really reflect how things work. Like, you compare this to a game like Democker, sure, which is about German parliament, and that game is like very much like these parties do this in this way, and you know, it's much more complicated to better replicate and simulate that system. The card play here is cool, though. So, you know, there's a lot of interesting things. There's a lot of back and forth. It's a lot of tug of war, push pull. To some degree, it's a bit of random draw luck. Like, you draw the cards and hopefully they have the states that you're trying to target on them. So it is very tactical in that way. So I would say there's parts of the game I had fun with. There's parts that I found a little dull. And then just generally as a representation of American political machinations and electoral politics, it doesn't really land on that front super well. So mechanically it's fine. So it's a play, like a light play for me. I wish I remember why I backed this. I played the prototype like 6-7 years ago when they had their first Kickstarter, and I remember liking it enough that it was in my mind, and then I backed it here. But playing through it now, I'm just like, I don't know if I'm older and more cynical, or just I want something a little bit more of a simulation. Like, I love 1960. I think it's a great game.
Sure.
Give me that in like modern, you know, electoral numbers, and that'd be awesome. Which I know they did in 2008, but that game's out of print. So campaign trail, it's fine. If you're looking for like a simulation level game, if you're looking for something more complex or a game that plays like it looks, because there's a lot of bits here, this is not it. The other thing I will say is that it's very fiddly. So you have a little cardboard marker for all 50 states plus DC, and these move between the tracks to show like who has control of them at any point.
Mm-hmm.
So when you take over a state, you have more voters there. You got to remember to move it, right? Because that's the score, right? At the end of the game, whoever has the most electoral votes wins. So if you forget to move them at the end of the game, probably every time you're going to have to go through and check every state. So it's almost not even worth having the track except to keep track during the game, but you're going to miss one, and it's happened. So that's fiddly. The voters are these little tokens, and they come in 1s, 3s, and 5s. But by the time you get to the end of the game, you have in some states like 10, 15, 20 votes. And it's hard to see what those are unless you lay them in the right direction. And then you got to make sure that they're on the right direction, because it's like the same shape, but slightly bigger. It's like the Marco Polo camel problem.
Mm-hmm.
It's just at the end of the game, there's bits everywhere. And then some of the states are small, right? And they even blow them out on the side. They're like, Rhode Island, it's this little circle. Like, why do I have 10 votes in Rhode Island? I don't know, but I do. So it's a little fiddly. It's a little messy. It's a decent production, for sure. It's from Gray Fox. Game has some interesting mechanics to it. Some of the cards are really interesting, but as a whole, it doesn't quite come together for me. So it's a very, very light play if you're interested in something thematic for the season. On the level of like just a general Euro game, it might be a borderline dodge.
Okay. I remember seeing this too, and I think it looked really exciting.
Right.
And it, like you said, especially having the four different political factions, I think added a lot of, you know, gameplay kind of concepts.
Yeah, it does. Yeah. And like the Green Party expansion, it's not just a new party. Like, there's modules that you throw in there to mess with the game. Like, mm-hmm. In the base game, you have like advertising and campaigning, but in this one, you have like other elements that come in, like surrogates and different like state components, and, you know, the relationships that you have across these things. Like, and that's interesting. I didn't play with all that stuff, so I can't speak to it. Like, I really didn't. We didn't touch the Green Party expansion at all. But I don't know that I want to.
Sure.
I don't know. I might still. Again, that's why I'm giving it a play. I'm like, I might play it again, but it's borderline for me.
So. Yeah, I think it might be worth playing with, like you said, with that extra module. Because again, it's at what point do you experience like, it sounds like, and it looks like there's a lot of fiddliness, like you said. There's just a lot of stuff on the board, and obviously you bring another party in, so there's a lot more stuff on the board. So visually, it's a lot to kind of just hold in your head.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like with every expansion that we pick up or the different modules that we come into play, it's like, is there a sweet spot for this, right? Is there something that just, like, it allows it to click, you know, and it makes it worth kind of dealing with all the trouble of the little pieces and things like that. So,
yeah,
I think I almost backed this myself. I just, I think at the time I didn't have the room for it, but I was, like you said, the fact that they went as far as having all four parties, I guess, is very instructive for American democratic practices these days. And as much as I love 1960, and there's a lot of other political games that are based on that, it's almost always a two-player game.
Yeah.
So it's nice to have, like, you could have multiple players at the table kind of jockeying for position.
Yeah, that is a nice thing, too. And you don't even have to, like, if you're like, no, I just want red versus blue.
Yeah. Right?
Which, whatever, it's fine. And you can still play with four players doing that.
Yes.
Right? The thing about the game that gets weird is if you want to play three players and not have the third party in there. Right.
Sure.
You don't really want to have, like, one person versus two people on a team.
No, and then, like, even politically, the libertarians kind of are the harder side of the Republicans, and the Green Party is the more progressive left side of the Democrats. So
right,
they would, again, historically kind of pull from either party. So
right, yeah, it's, I don't know why I got stuck on that. I was just like, this isn't how this works, though. Like,
yeah.
I wish it did. I wish we had, like, an open system, but it's not really how this works at all. So.
Well,
Democrats aren't going to win Texas anytime soon. Republicans can't win California. What is happening here?
Yeah, it's a thing.
Yeah, but it's, you know, that's me being silly. There's interesting things here. I don't know. I got to try it again, but I don't know what I was expecting, but it's doing a lot with of different types of things. But,
maybe they needed to, and again, maybe you can't do this, but, like, maybe they needed to take it into the future a little bit, right? Because, like you said, different times in history, different parties could, like, Republicans did win California, right?
Reagan, a long time ago.
Reagan won California.
Sure.
So, and Texas has almost flipped Democrat a couple of times.
Right.
So maybe if they, you know, put this game in, like, the year 2300 or something like that, you know.
It does feel like they're trying to make it as agnostic as possible.
Sure.
Like, by having so many parties, but B, like, None of these candidates look like anybody. Like, they went out of... Sure. I don't know how they... There's, like, 30 candidates in the box, too, and each of them's double-sided. You have different genders, which is great. But they're, like, they really made sure none of these people looked like anybody who's actually alive.
It's the political, non-political game.
Yeah.
So, not very cool. All right. Well, I have the opposite here for Anthony. I didn't show this to you before on screen. For those of you who have the secret, super secret... BGA Patreon backed edition where you can watch the screen as we broadcast. I'm about to show Anthony a game I backed on Kickstarter last year. I should say I backed this specifically for the reason that they promised that it was ready to go and that we would get it by late November, so I would have a time for PAX. So I was like, hey, I'm meeting with people. Do I have something fast and fun to play? And this came up on Kickstarter, so I'm going to show it to Anthony. And
that is ridiculous. I love it.
So what I'm showing Anthony here, for those of you who don't have the super secret BGA backstage pass, is the brand new game that just came out from Kickstarter Fulfilled. It's Circle Tunes HD. You may be familiar with them on YouTube. They have like 2.3 or 2.5 million followers on there, almost as much as we have. And it's primarily a very fun YouTube channel and very much, as the name states, like these very simple circle tunes, right? Like stick figures, but kind of filled in. And mostly the channel is almost all humor stuff, but mostly video game stuff. And the creator of that channel decided to come out with a tabletop game in the kind of realm of Munchkin. And the box itself, because the game comes down to the main mechanic or, like, play is about building your own, I guess in this case, fool's blade. You're building a sword. So if you know anything about Munchkin, which we've talked about many times, it is a wacky, cartoony, comical kind of take on RPGs. So Fool's Blade, in that same genre, is also a wacky, comical take on RPGs, but instead of just, you know, having a card or two that gives you a weapon, this one allows you to craft your blade, your sword, with a bunch of different odd pieces to it. So the game box, which is a really bad idea, but I backed it anyway, is a very wide and very thick, wacky sword. It kind of was a throwback. What was it? Adam's Apple Games that had that sword.
Oh yeah.
Construction game. And I remember we I think that was actually in Gen Con where we had tried that out. And it was a very cool game. And I was like, oh, I get to build swords because swords building is cool. And this would be wacky. So Anthony, the blade lifts off and it's again, very wide, very tall. And that's where it holds all the cards.
Nice.
So it does fit everything and everything's sleeved. Some sleeves came with it. Some sleeves were extra. And very tiny little rule book, which I'll talk about in a second. And then in the hilt here, it has a little secret draw. I also have the expansion to this. And the game itself was $25. So that was not too expensive plus shipping. The expansion was a little expensive considering that the base game was $25. I think the expansion was $15, which is Fool's Blade Screaming Forest, which adds some artwork from different designers and adds some additional cards. It's basically more of the same. Not that it's bad, it's more of the same. So, what's Fool's Blade about? Well, Fool's Blade's a fast-paced, comical, chaotic sword-crafting card game. All right, cool. You got me at that. And again, very much like Munchkin, as far as you are playing an RPG with other adventurers, and you are fighting monsters. So the game is pretty simple and straightforward. Artwork is pretty cute. And primarily what you're doing in the game is you're messing with other people. And in particular, you are going to different areas on the board, and each area is going to allow you to do different things. So at the start of the game, you go to the tavern. The tavern is where you pick up cards that allow you to mess with other people, like steal cards from them, do some take that stuff to them when they fight monsters later on, or give you specific bonuses. So that happens at the beginning of each round. Then there's this assembly phase. So we talked about the sword crafting. So with the sword crafting, it's pretty interesting. And this is like the part that I was really interested in. There is a card for the pommel, the bottom of the sword. There's cards for the handle, cards for the guards, and cards for the blades. So you're building a sword out of four different pieces. Now, in the cards, there is swords that are made up of four pieces. So like you can collect a set of the right four pieces. If you do, you get a bonus for that. If you don't worry about it, because you can mix and match the parts on the sword, and that will give you different benefits. So the swords themselves have a kind of Pokemon-style benefit and weakness. So your swords could be just a normal sword piece that adds just more power to attacking monsters as far as strength is concerned. And then there's water, fire, and plant type. So plants are nothing against fire. Fire is nothing against water, and water is nothing against plants. But if you're, for example, fighting a fire monster and you have some water elements on your sword, they're going to do double damage. So it allows you to kind of craft a sword with either one type or multiple types and benefits you. As you travel around, once you build your sword up, you'll have an opportunity to go to the forge, which allows you to pick up more pieces for your sword and to build it. You can go questing. Questing gives you an opportunity to get curses, which are typically not good for you, but also there's benefits and gears that you could pick up. And then the primary part of the game that you're going to score points on is about monster hunting. So there's three different decks, there are three different levels, and you are going to attack that monster if you have more strength than that monster based upon your sword and all your different gear, then you win. but other players can throw stuff to make the monster more powerful or make you weaker. So again, it's just like Munchkin as far as that's concerned. What's not like Munchkin is it's not about levels, it's about loot. So the game comes to an end when all the loot has been expended. So once loot is gone, the game comes to an end. There is each of the loot gives you points towards the end, but there's also special loot that will give you special abilities and also loot that will give you special parts to your sword. And there is also opportunity to double wield, so you can actually have two swords in the game. Because the game itself starts with a class, and it's all the typical RPG, D&D kind of classes, and some fun stuff in between. So it's wacky, it's comical, it's Munchkin in a lot of ways. I do enjoy the sword crafting, because not only do you get a class, but you get to craft your sword, and that's pretty fun. And the take that stuff is kind of part of the charm. I'm not the biggest fan of that kind of charm, but it's there.
And like Munchkin, it's fine.
It's Munchkin, it's fine. And there's also a boss element to the game. So as you're fighting creatures, there's cards that'll pop up that will say the boss is approaching. And then there is a cooperative moment that if you get the boss cards come out, then you and everyone at the table have to fight the boss together. And if you defeat the boss, just like you defeat the regular monsters, you get a benefit. If you don't, you take a penalty. So do your best to fight monsters, to collect loot, deal with the other people that are trying to do the same thing. And whoever has the most loot at the end of the game, once the loot runs out, wins. So Fool's Blade is very specific audience. So if you're a big fan of the art style of Circle Toons HDs, I think you'll enjoy this as a, I won't say a Munchkin clone, but it certainly has a lot of Munchkin elements to it. Mm-hmm. If you don't like the artwork here, I think you'll still enjoy crafting the swords and dealing with the particular class and some of the inside jokes for the RPG stuff. So I would say, again, very particular, very niche. If you're a Circle Toons fan, this you probably back this on Kickstarter, and then it's probably a buy for you. For me, it's a play. It doesn't have as much of the hard kind of gameplay that I was hoping for. I do like the collection. You know, you're collecting cards from a deck, so it can be random. Like, you're not getting the pieces that you need to craft your sword. You can obviously go to the blacksmith to get more sword pieces, but otherwise people are doing other things. So it offers that kind of Munchkin feel, but not Munchkin. So it's a little more complicated than Munchkin in some ways, a little more text than Munchkin in other ways, and a little more streamlined than Munchkin in other ways. So if you liked Munchkin, this might be for you. That's kind of what I looked at it. I was like, light, easy, fun, cartoony, mess with your friends at the table, and build a silly, stupid sword, which you can fight monsters with. So, Circle Toons, HD, Fool's Blade gets a play for me.
All right.
Yeah.
That's cool.
And it's giant and silly.
It's cute. It's a giant box. I love everything about it, but then you said Munchkin, and I'm out. For audio listeners, Chris is swinging it around like a lightsaber.
Yeah, because you got to do those things.
Yeah. So.
I will force Anthony to play this at least once because he's going to want to play with the giant box.
Built like a sword. I will. Yeah.
Eventually, at some point in the future, we will. I don't think we have a top 10, a top 10 game of swords, but maybe we at least have two, maybe three or four out there. All right, so that's everything that we wanted that hit the table this week, Anthony. Now on to our feature review. Our feature review this week is, of course, talking about the latest and greatest. This time, we're talking about video games going analog, going from bits and pixels into cardboard and meeples. Anthony, tell us about all the greatness of video games going cardboard.
All right. So, video games are awesome, right? We know that.
Whoa, hot take there, buddy.
I know.
Pull it back.
All right, we're going to all tear it down. But the thing about it is, like, converting a video game into a board game is difficult. And I think part of the reason for that is it's too often they try to capture everything, right? Mm-hmm. let's get all the stuff that works in the video game and make it work in a board game. And it doesn't work because the video game is unique in a lot of ways. It's a different medium. You can't translate everything. Like same way, like when you adapt a book into a film, you can't just do a one-for-one adaptation because the film would be 13 hours long. It doesn't work. So when we do translations of analog or video games into analog, like we take that digital thing and with all its fancy bits and background and hundreds of millions of dollars of development, and you turn it into a board game, what are some of the things that make it work? Mm-hmm. So we've broken it down into six specific things.
Sure.
That seem to be the most effective way to kind of make these adjustments. Mm. And so a lot of these games are recent, not all of them. Some of them are older, but we're going to look at like what it is about these particular games that works and what they have in common. So first up, we have the cooperative campaign. This is something that, if anything, kind of adjusts the system of a video game into a multiplayer board game, because most video games, not all, but most are single player experiences. So how do you take a single player experience and turn it into a tabletop game that is potentially also has a single player experience in it with a solo mode, but can be played with other people? Because that is one of the defining characteristics of board games, is that they're generally communal activities. So recent examples are Slay the Spire, which I reviewed a few weeks ago, which is a game without any multiplayer components, but they made it a cooperative game in which each player is playing as a character and they kind of work together to fight through things. And it works extremely well because it streamlines so much of that game down without losing all the pieces that make it unique as a card game, as a deck builder. And it does that by keeping it cooperative and having you work with other people. Mm-hmm. If you play it solo, it really just feels like the video game on the table, which is fine. But you play it cooperatively and it's like a new thing. Dwarf Romantic, which won the Spiel des Jahres in 2023, also based on a video game. And that video game, again, a solo player experience, a single player experience that's kind of a puzzle game. And they turned it into a cooperative campaign style game in which you're building up through these new modules. So other ones that worked really well, This War of Mine, the very solitaire experience. It's depressing, it's dark. How do you make that into a board game? It's still depressing, it's still dark, but now you're doing it with other people. So let's work together. And then Frostpunk, again, similarly, like this, you know, kind of post-apocalyptic survival experience. How do we translate that to cardboard? Well, let's put everybody together and try to survive together, right? So it's a common theme. And some of the other games we'll talk about, too, are also this. But these ones in particular are going to stand out. So cooperative games. It's a funny thing. Like, I'm trying to think of how many cooperative video games there even are, right?
Mm. There's a lot of them out there. And oftentimes they're kind of overlooked. They don't really state the game, or that's not the selling point of the game. Like, if you didn't know Pandemic, you would be like, oh, all games are competitive, so this would make sense. But yeah, no, I think it's even more unusual for video games to have that kind of, I don't know what you would say, the cooperative element to it, because video games are very much like, we think first person shooters and things of that nature, or you know, but these things do work so very well, and I think they even work better in person, right? Because the cooperative element is having somebody across from you and like strategize in every way possible. And sometimes a lot of these cooperative games, not even speaking, just like the sense of how do you, you know, carry that burden, right? This war of mine.
Right. Yeah. And the thing that these games all have in common is the video games are big, sprawling, complex puzzles.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're going to convert that to cardboard, like, well, why don't we work on solving the puzzle together?
Yes.
Which is something that Leacock solved for us, you know, 16 years ago with Pandemic. You can take a very complex puzzle, you put a bunch of people around the table to work on it, and it becomes this very interesting, engaging, cooperative experience.
Yes, for sure.
All right, so those are our four. And again, that doesn't mean that's all of them. There's a lot more out there. This is not meant to be a comprehensive list. Another thing that we do see occasionally, like, and back in the day we saw more of this and it didn't always work, but the one-to-one translation, where a game tries to take everything that works in the video game and find a way to represent it in the tabletop game, One game that does this to varying degrees of effectiveness is Stardew Valley.
Mm.
Stardew Valley is it's a farming game, but it's also a sprawling experience in a lot of other ways. There's a relationship manager in there. There's mining. There's questing you can do. There's a lot going on in that game because Concerned Ape, the developer, has been working on it now for 10 plus years. The board game, which was produced by Concerned Ape and its company, is 5 million pieces in that box, right? It's icon, it's everything everywhere. And it works. The game works, but it is a sprawling, fiddly experience in a lot of ways. Like, it's what you'd think if you're like, well, what? How do you take a farming simulator and turn it into a board game? Like, make everything into cardboard, which is what they did. So it all fits into one, like, Ticket to Ride size box, but it is packed, and there's a lot of cardboard in there. Another one that kind of just throws everything in the kitchen sink at the game is Europa Universalis. This is one that we actually got a chance to check out at Gen Con 6 years ago.
Sure.
When they were still, like, working on it. And it's out now. People have it. But it is a big, sprawling map and all these different elements involved. And I remember them, like, demoing the game for us. And it was a good 30, 40 minute discussion nonstop of, like, and then you do this, and then you do this, and then you do this, and then you do this. And if you do this, it affects this, and this affects this, and this affects this. Like, it is a very complex game, and the reason it's so complex is because they decided, hey, let's take everything from the video game and find a way to represent it on the table.
Yeah.
And by all accounts, they did a very good job of that, if that's what you want to do. So the people who like it claim it to be one of the best games ever made. It has a weight rating of almost 5, like 4.7, one of the heaviest games on Board Game Geek. It's just such an amazing accomplishment to be able to take that and make it work in the context of, you know, everything that's going on here. So, yeah, Europa Universalis, it's a big sprawl. I would never play it. It'd probably take 3 weeks to learn. But the people who figured it, who do play it, really love it. And it is about as close as you can get to a one-to-one version of the game.
It's an accomplishment.
Yeah. Next up, we have games that just kind of ignore the original conceit of the game entirely. They're like, yeah, let's take the theme and do what we want with it. Famously, you've always been like, what is Mechs versus Minions? What are they doing here?
It's true.
Right? Like, this is supposed to be League of Legends, I think, right?
It's supposed to be. It's League of Legends adjacent. It's in the, it's the same universe, more or less.
Yeah, so this is like a, it's cooperative, and it's a programming game. And it's beautiful, and it uses the IP, but it's not a MOBA in any meaningful way. So, and this was one of the very first things they did to expand that universe, which is even weirder, because now they've done more stuff, right? There's a TV show, and there's, like, various other games in world. But this one in particular is just like, what are you doing? It's a good game.
Oh, it's a very good game. Yes.
So yeah, Mechs versus Minions is one. Master of Orion, the board game, is another one that I really enjoyed. But Master of Orion is, it's a strategy video game, like an older one. It's very much in the, like, 4X vein of things, right? You play as a alien species, and you go out, and you're engaging with the other ones, and it's like this big sprawling map, and you're building these different trade routes, and like, there's a lot going on. The board game is a very small box, like Res Arcana sized, all card driven, and it's, I don't know, it's basically Race for the Galaxy, like, in terms of tableau building, but then you have, like, your own personal player mat with your race on it. So it's not, it has the elements, but it's not doing all the things that you would think you'd need to do in a 4X game. It's like, they're like, we got the license, let's make a Masters of Orion game, but we don't have the money, time, or resources to make a Twilight Imperium clone, so we're not going. So another thing that we see a lot is miniatures. Miniatures, like, hey, there's a lot of characters in this game, how do we represent them? Plastic. Most recently, we saw The Witcher got a big sprawling release on GameFound, and just hundreds of dollars to get all the different pieces. Definitely not the only one. There's been Bloodborne, Elden Ring was recently. There's Dark Souls was another big one. Like, these big massive crowdfunding campaigns for hundreds of dollars worth of miniatures from games that are known for like their monster design. And they're like adventure type games. So like, how do we make an adventure type video game into a board game? We throw a bunch of miniatures on a map and have people walk around. And that's effectively what we get there. StarCraft, the board game, is not that. It's a very different take on that, as similarly with Warcraft, the board game.
Sure.
These are old games, though, right? That we never got re-released. StarCraft came back as Forbidden Stars a few years ago, but that quickly went out of print.
Yeah, sure.
Warcraft, the board game, never came back as really anything. So they're older, and it's really, it was their best way of replicating that Blizzard style of, here's a bunch of stuff on the map. Let's just put a bunch of stuff literally on the map, which is what those games did. And then Doom, the board game, is the precursor to like Descent and all of those games, like the one versus many dungeon crawls. So obviously it's miniatures, which honestly, of all of these, this is the one that makes the most sense for me, because that is a game where you are one guy running around killing a bunch of stuff, right?
Yes.
So it should just be a bunch of miniatures on a map.
I mean, they're all, it's a great concept, because since they are video games, you don't really get to handle pieces. And the pieces are so essential to the gameplay, and they're so iconic to the gameplay. Even StarCraft, even the little, you know, little figures in that, like, just so, just part of our childhood, part of our gameplay. So having those actually in real physical presence and have a good game that goes along with it is just tremendous.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, this makes it, tangible and touchable in a way that video games can't be. So another trick that I have seen over the years is just bringing in a famous designer, just giving them a license to play with.
Yes.
Martin Wallace recently made Anno 1800 based on the video game. Glenn Drover, famously Age of Empires 3 back in the day. Kevin Wilson worked on Sid Meier's Civilization. So there's a lot of, like, you get the license, you pay for that, right? It costs money. You want to make sure it gets done right. You bring in somebody to work on it. It doesn't always work, though. Like, Ignacy Trevicek worked on the Witcher Adventure game for Fantasy Flight. I think that game is terrible. I think it's the worst game Trevicek has ever made.
Sure.
But they got the name, they got somebody well-known, and they brought him in. Yes. And, that game continues to exist because of the person who worked on it. Last but not least, we have cards. Like, let's just make a card game, right? How do we get this video game? We just take the IP, we throw it on some cards. The most famous by a long shot is the Pokemon trading card game, which did this first back in the 90s. And ironically, they went from Pokemon to the trading card game back to Pokemon trading card game, the video game. It's been around for, almost 30 years now at this point, and is one of the most successful card games on the planet. Bloodborne and God of War, the card game. These both came from CMON a few years apart. They use kind of the same system from Eric Lang. So just a relatively simple small box card game that was pretty pasteable. I'm surprised they didn't bring more IPs in, but maybe they didn't sell enough copies of these games.
Sure.
And then Level 99 had their Exceed system.
Yes.
Which is like this dueling card game. And they got the licenses for Shovel Knight, as well as Street Fighter.
Yeah.
So those kind of bringing in games that kind of fit that just naturally. Chris holds up his copy of Street Fighter. Yeah, fantastic.
There you go.
Yeah. I think I have Shovel Knight downstairs, actually. So yeah, there's a lot of different ways to do it. And we've gotten past the point where we're like, oh, you can't adapt that. You can't make that work. It's like, no, there's a lot of ways that we figured out to do it. The most recent, the most effective in recent years has been cooperative campaigns. Dwarf Romantic won the Spiel des Jahres, right?
Yes.
Some of these games are really highly rated. Slay the Spire has like a 9 on Board Game Geek. It works really well, but that's not the only way to do it. And so it's fun to see what kind of games are going to make that transition, how they're going to do it. And ultimately, what new mechanics are brought in that are either new to that video game franchise or are just new to board gaming in general, because you have to figure out a way to make it work.
It's a big step, And since we've been around for so long at this point, it was not always the case. If you brought in a video game to make a board game version of it, it was typically awful. Mm-hmm. And now we have some of the best tabletop games, and they stand on their own. And
yeah, yeah.
I haven't played, you know, Slay the Spire in tabletop version. I played the video game a lot, but people like it more, and they're just like, they're championing it as its own game. Like, it's just fantastic. You mentioned Dwarf Romantic, obviously, had won an award, you know, so fits very well. And this War of Mine and Frostpunk, while they were very big video games, they kind of own a space in tabletop gaming, even considering both those games are very dark dystopian futures that go along with it. The idea of sharing that together, or sharing that trauma, more or less, is a big thing. And then I remember Stardew Valley coming out, and again, because of the video game, people were hyped for it, and they picked it up. And then again, turned out to be an excellent game. And then people were looking for second, third, fourth editions coming out for that game because it was so big. So we're really blessed across the board that these designers have done such a good job of just not phoning it in and giving us just, you know, a nothing kind of transition, because people would have picked it up, at least initially, and it would have damaged, I think, both in the end. So bravo, at the very least.
Yeah, yeah, no, it's cool. It brings more people into the hobby.
Yes.
In both directions, honestly, and it seems to be worth pursuing as just a way to get people engaged with different genres and different types of games. I wish they weren't all $200 on Kickstarter.
Sure.
A lot of these new ones, especially with the miniatures,
the IPs are killers.
Yeah, like the God of War one, we didn't bring that one up, but that Simon had a God of War campaign pretty recently that was several hundred dollars to get everything. And I'm like, I love that IP. I love the video game, but I'm like, I wasn't going to pay for that. So with no gameplay to look at. But at the same time, we do get clever stuff. Dwarf Romantic, not a Kickstarter game, right? Stardew Valley, sold directly by the publisher. Very cool. So lots of good innovation, lots of interesting ways to look at things. And yeah, cynically, it is like a lot of like, we have this IP, how can we use it? But if it breeds innovation and new ways to approach the games, I'm all for it.
Sure. Absolutely. All right, so that's everything for this week. Until next time, this is Chris.
And this is Anthony.
And we'll save you all. Let's see you at the table. Take care, everyone.
Mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hey y'all, Darius Rucker here. You know, a lot of people ask me, what inspires your music? And one of the big things is a strong sense of place. That's why I love my home state of South Carolina and want to share the awesome things it has to offer. From the beautiful mountains down to the sunny coast, it's got it all. Not to mention two of my personal favorites, great golf and amazing food. Come see why I love this place. Visit discoversouthcarolina.com.